Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Good evening and welcome to Word in Your Ear. We haven't been here for a while. Well, we were here last night, but, you know, we haven't done a Word in Your Ear for a few months before that. So it's nice to be back. The actual date for your diary, the next one is on May the 9th. Is that right? Isn't it? And we're doing a Nielsen and Newman evening. So we got
Randy Newman. Gary Newman.
No, Gary.
Sorry.
And Gary Newman and Donald Nielsen, yeah. We think it might be one of the less popular.
Pasty-faced android special.
Okay. So much for my smooth bit of programming, yeah, though. Cool. But okay. So we start tonight, as usual, in two halves. The second half devoted to some chancer who's written a book about 1971. But first, we welcome back an old friend of the podcast and Word in Your Ear in the past, a biographer of Stevie Nicks, of the Jesus and Mary Chain. The Slits, okay. We also call her, she's our Essex correspondent, you know, which is particularly applicable in the case of this book, which is all about Lee Brillo of Dr. Feelgood, Rock and Roll Gentleman. Would you please welcome Zoe Howe? So, Zoe, obvious question, why a book about Lee Brillo?
Well, I guess the starting point for me to think about wanting to write about Lee and look into who he was, sort of in his own right, and also, of course, as the front man of Dr. Feelgood, was when I went to see Oil City Confidential, which is, I'm sure many of you know, a wonderful Julian Temple film about the Feelgoods. And it just kind of blew my head off for all sorts of reasons. It was amazing. But I just also thought, wow, you know, obviously Wilco was very much sort of the star of that film, and, you know, he's so charismatic and hilarious and charming. But I also thought, you know, Lee was this sort of mystery. You know, obviously he's not here anymore, but he kind of was a different kind of personality to Wilco. You know, he was less kind of concerned with the limelight, I suppose. He was sort of less starry in his way. And I just thought, well, I'd like to know more about him. He seems really, really fascinating. And I had glimpses of who he was, and sort of quite unexpected glimpses. Like, you know, he used to write these quite surreal poems and do these kind of strange, kind of almost Spike Milligan-style writings as a teenager. And, you know, he was very well read. And then he became this very sort of almost a kind of country squire kind of figure, right, in his 30s, you know, and it's just lots of quite eccentric elements to his personality. So I thought, yeah, I'd like to know more about him. And I thought, well, maybe I should sort of look into writing about him. And I'd also done the book with Wilco Johnson, Looking Back at Me. So I thought maybe this could be a kind of companion to that book.
So is this why it's called Rock and Roll Gentleman? Did you start with that title, or did it occur along the way?
It occurred along the way, but the funny thing was that everybody I spoke to, without fail, for this book, the first thing they would say about Lee was he was such a gentleman. And I just thought, this is, you know, it was such a recurring theme. I thought that's got to be on the cover then.
What do you take that to mean when people tell you that in the kind of music business context? It's quite telling, isn't it? When people say, he's a gentleman.
Yeah, that's why it was such a big thing.
What does that mean? He's not going to chase you or whatever. I mean, what do you make of it?
Well, I think, yeah, that was quite an interesting point, because I thought, you know, when you see footage of the Feelgoods and you see him on stage and he's this quite ferocious, quite sort of sexual presence, very, very kind of, you know, alpha male stalking the stage, and quite obscene, you know, performances live. You think, yeah, the word gentleman maybe doesn't spring to mind immediately.
No.
But I think, you know, off stage, he was a very different kind of person and quite mild-mannered, very kind, and he took manners very seriously. And, you know, he looked after people and he was generous to the support acts and certain things that were kind of rarities in the music business. And I suppose that's
describing him as a closet toff at one point, I think, which is a brilliant idea.
Yeah.
So as if he wanted to be a kind of faux aristocratic figure.
Right.
Yes, yeah, so he was sort of, he'd right at the end of his homework at school, his name was Lee Collinson Esquire, and sort of things like that. So it goes right back to sort of being quite young, I think.
So when was he born? What year? How old was he?
He was born in 1952.
Right, okay.
And actually, he's the only member of the sort of definitive feel-good lineup who actually wasn't from Canby Island. His family were Londoners. He was actually born in South Africa. His family kind of moved out there for a while, and then he moved back to Ealing. And then when he was about 8 years old, his grandparents lived on Canby Island, and they'd go and visit, and he was just totally taken with the whole atmosphere there.
Let's talk a little bit about Canby Island. You know, this very alluring
irresistible
postcard.
As you can see.
You know, that was a vision of pleasure in the post-war years.
Beauty.
Would turn anybody's head. I have to confess, I've never been to Canby Island. You are our Essex correspondent. You know, what are the key elements of Canby Island? If you had to explain Canby Island to a Martian, imagine I'm a Martian. Go on.
Well, I think Canby Island has very much got its own identity, and it may be because it's an island. You know, it's got its own thing going on, and they don't really care what anybody else thinks, and they sort of just do their own thing a bit. And I think maybe that's why Lee was particularly drawn as a personality to it, because he kind of reflects a lot of the qualities in him. You know, didn't really care what anybody else thinks, just does what he likes. And that was a sort of Canby thing. You know, I think, and also at the time, it was quite a lot more rural. And as a boy from London, you know, sort of post-war London, you know, to go to Canby Island and spend time on the beach and kind of sort of... It was almost like a kind of rural
blues folklore as well, that they sort of thought of it as being the Essex Delta, like the Mississippi Delta equivalent in England, and that Wilco Johnson was the Robert Johnson of the Essex Delta.
Yes.
They built a whole fantasy based around it, didn't
Absolutely,
they?
Absolutely, yeah, the Thames Delta, they used to call it. And
the refinery, they always talked about the light, there's an oil refinery, isn't
that's
it?
Right.
I suppose the Rolling Stones were Dartford, weren't they? So
yeah.
It's all kind of.
You could see that the
same
sky
direction,
would be lit
there.
Up with extraordinary lights.
Absolutely, and up until quite recently, those flaming lights over the refineries were still flaming away over Canby, and it's quite a sort of strange post-apocalyptic kind of landscape and quite mysterious. And so you had all of that, and you had the old Canby shacks as well. And so I suppose there were, you know, it was easy to draw comparisons.
So they made their own kind of glamour out of it, out of, you know, what wasn't obviously promising material. This is a map of Canby Island. Is there a posh bit and a kind of, you know... I don't know. I've no idea.
There's uptown.
Is there a difficult urban bit or whatever?
Well, this was sort of... That end was known as the nice end of Canby.
Here's the nice end.
That was the nice end.
Tropical rainforest.
And so you could look over here. Who lives in the nice end? You'd have the view of Hadley Castle. There's a kind of ruined castle.
Oh, right. So you look that way and it's all better.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Right. So whereas if you look the other way, it's kind of worse, is it?
If you look that way, you've got the refineries on Stanford La Hope, a.k.a. Stanford No Hope, as that probably tells you a bit about.
They call Basildon Baz Vegas.
Yes, Baz Vegas.
They sort of revelled in that kind of ghastly, chintzy awfulness.
Yeah, they sort of turned it on its head.
Proud of it, exactly.
Absolutely, and there was a kind of glamour in that, and I think also... And again, it sort of precedes the punk attitude thing. So when the feel-goods did start to kind of start getting somewhere and getting some attention, the whole thing of it wasn't sort of, we'd better move to London or we better sort of play the game. It was like, no, they can come to us.
Yes.
And they did in their droves.
Yeah, because that became part of their thing. Tell us about Lee as a schoolboy. This is from his school exercise book, isn't it?
So inventive and funny.
What kind of person was he as a... You know, teenager.
Well, this is one of the main, my favourite kind of periods of the Lee story was Lee as a teenager, because, you know, I was very fortunate that one of his old school friends had kept lots and lots of exercise books that they'd sort of written sort of crazy stories and done these sort of Heath Robinson style diagrams. It was all very, very inventive. But Lee Collinson, aka Collie, as he was known as a kid, was massively ahead of his time. And I think everybody really looked up to him. It was almost like he was at least 5 years ahead of everybody.
Of the rest of the boys in the school?
Yeah.
Really?
And he was quite a commanding character. I think possibly occasionally a bit of a bully, I think.
Right.
You know, he was quite anarchic and he strained against the rules.
This is tremendous irony, isn't it? Point six is pupils with imaginations must not bring them to school. It's a lovely idea, isn't it?
Yeah, he was sort of, you know...
Each schoolboy must have a head. That's so funny.
I just
but
love
it must
them.
Not be in excess of 20 inches in diameter. So brilliant.
Yeah. It's very late 60s rag mag, isn't it, this kind of thing, you know?
It's slightly surreal. Wasn't Viv Stanchel of the Bonzos from Southend?
There was a connection. Yeah, Viv Stanchel was a Leon C.
Big fans
of
the Bonzos.
Definitely.
Nonsense.
Yeah, all of that, the Monty Python, but Spike Milligan.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely
Bonzo,
loved
yeah,
it.
Nick, Viv Stanchel was the interesting thing that one parent was very tough and
that's
one
right.
wasn't.
Well, one was working class.
And his whole act was moving between
was,
the two.
Was exactly being one and the other.
Absolutely.
That's between, very interesting. We've stumbled across something there.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but he's quite good at school, isn't he? He's quite strong at school, but he doesn't kind of carry on with it at all, does he?
No.
He could have done.
He could have done.
Presumably could have gone to university and whatever.
Absolutely.
But didn't particularly have an interest in doing that.
No, I sort of got the impression he just sort of wanted to kind of get on with life. But I think in later years, and it's been talked about, you know, he didn't go to university, Wilco Johnson did. And I think maybe, you know, he sort of felt a little bit, maybe, you know, insecure about that.
But these were in the days when people could leave school and get a job straight away as a solicitor's clerk, didn't he?
Yeah, that's right.
Serving writs on people and, and all that, which he took to.
He loved it because it was almost like, I think the thing with Lee as well that really comes across, he likes a sort of a bit of a sense of theatre and sort of being able to kind of dress up a bit. And so he'd have this sort of sharp pinstripe suit and they gave him a sort of company car to sort of pose around in. And he just sort of enjoyed the pose, and he said because it's on Canvey Island, things work differently on Canvey, and it was, you know, he could pretty much just do what he liked, and the governor wasn't really around very much, so it was just
right.
He just sort of spent his time kind of placing bets on horses and posing around in his suit.
So by then he's got an interest in music, which he's pursuing.
Yeah, this was a little bit before, so he would have been in his teens, possibly about 14 here. This is his jug band. He became obsessed with the blues, really became a kind of scholar of it, and sort of collected records and turned a lot of his friends onto it as well. And they formed a jug band, and they sort of trolled around busking, and they did the famous World Tour of Kent. That was one of theirs.
And won an impromptu fourth prize.
Won an impromptu fourth prize at Canvey Carnival. Bernard Brain, MP, awarded it to them. And here we have, standing up at the end, that's Chris Fenwick, who would go on to be...
Was a very important figure, isn't
it? A very important figure, yeah. He was the, still is, Dr. Feelgood's manager, very much Lee's right-hand man. And we also have Sparko, Feelgood bassist, I think that's on the guitar there. So it was very much a kind of nascent Feelgood thing. But he's playing guitar here, but then he would go on, you know, obviously to be a singer. But
so Chris Fenwick... A drama student, wasn't he? Was that his thing?
Yeah, he became an actor. That was another sort of part of his
life.
That's
another part of the Dr. Feelgood thing, isn't it? They were kind of... They were dressing up and playing a part, weren't they?
Yes, definitely. And I like that sort of sense of, you know, almost vaudevillian kind of dressing up and, you know, playing the show and putting it, you're all into it and all of your energy and sort of treating it as a piece of theatre almost.
Right.
Which was very thrilling and obviously being quite different people off stage. But yeah, this is obviously an early publicity shot of the Chaps.
So when's this, roughly?
Well, this would probably be 71.
Because wasn't Wilco is only just starting to come back from his hitchhiking to India and doing his kind of hippie stuff, and he was wearing kaftans.
That's
and things,
right,
wasn't
he? Yeah.
So what had changed in him? Was it just his interest in blues that made him drop all that psychedelic stuff and get involved with him?
I don't know if that ever really went away, to be honest, but I think, you know... Because he was about 5 years older than Lee, and when he came back from India, you know, I mean, Lee really looked up to him, and he loved hearing these stories about, you know, India, and obviously Wilco had gone to university and read all these books, and he was very political, and that really kind of inspired Lee in lots of ways. Possibly at the time, you know, ways that Wilco could have never imagined, I think, you know, because there was a bit of that alpha male thing going on, because despite the age gap... Wilco was also quite in awe of Lee as a character as well, even though he was a lot younger. It was like, wow, this is quite a special person.
Yeah.
And they were really, really good friends in those days as well. And I know that, you know, it's terribly sad the way it, you know, developed. And,
as
and
we shall discover.
Indeed, indeed. But they were very close and had
but
a lot
you,
of laughs.
You always believe that the bands never change the hierarchy of age, do they?
I've always thought that was the case, you know. Like the
Go
Beatles,
on, explain.
You know? Well, just if John Lennon's the oldest and Paul McCartney's 2 years younger than him, and actually Ringo was older than John Lennon, wasn't it? But George Harrison's the one. Then those hierarchies are set in place as they would be in a school classroom, and they never really change. And actually, at the very end of the Beatles, that they still thought of George as this little nipper who was lucky to be in the group at all, you know, even though he was 27 or whatever.
Right.
And I'm sure exactly the same thing was set in stone here, really.
Yeah, those, absolutely.
It's
absolutely
like looking up to elder brothers or teachers or whatever.
So they put the group together and they start playing where?
Well, they start playing, sort of pubs around Canvey Island, Southend-on-Sea, Southend Esplanade. And also they got a chance to... I mean, they played a lot of kind of functions, and they sort of tried to put sort of rock and roll covers into their set just to sort of please the punters. And they play at sort of awful pubs like the Railway and Pitsy, a.k.a. the Flying Bottle. And it was all kind of quite...
the glamour.
And I think that's where a lot of Lee's...
So there were some fairly unreconstructed Teds, were they? Knocking around.
There were,
kind of
yeah. And I think it was. I think that's why they kind of... Well, I think they knew what they wanted to do, and they loved the blues things. It was very tough and quite sort of mean. But, you know, playing in places like that, Lee sort of really stepped that up because it was almost like you kind of had to front out the crowd a little bit.
Kill or be killed.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a lot of truth in that.
Yeah, so you sort of
do. Is it around about this time that they go and see Howlin' Wolf in the back room of a pub in Essex?
Well, actually, that would have been a little bit earlier. I think that would have been in the 60s. So Lee would have still been at school, and he and Chris Fenwick went down. I think Chris was still in his school uniform when they went down. There's a pub in Romford called King's Head. I don't know if it's there anymore, but Howlin' Wolf was playing.
And it said outside, Howlin' Wolf, tonight.
It's mad.
In Romford, for one night only. wasn't there a slightly obscene dimension to Howlin' Wolf's stage act? Which Lee was quite impressed by and did all sorts of amusing things with microphones.
Indeed, I think all of those things come from Howlin' Wolf. The sort of this kind of ejaculating beer bottle antics and all that kind of thing totally comes from...
That's what
he was doing. Yeah, Howlin' Wolf was doing all of that and kind of... You know, Lee was really lit up by that performance and just couldn't believe, you know, this quite old guy, you know, at the time, just sort of tore it up in this sort of room in this very unatmospheric pub in East London, and the sort of daylight still streaming through the windows, no atmosphere, but he just rocked, you know.
Yeah. So I don't know exactly what year this is, but yeah, it's round about this time. Tell us about the development of the look, because, you know, you look at the earlier pictures and it's just a bunch of guys... You know, in denims that have turned up to play. Whereas here, you've got, you know, the look that that made Dr. Feelgood, haven't you?
Absolutely, and it's got. I mean, it's. I like it because they're all quite distinct, but it's a sort of united front. But, you know, he makes me think of Jake Blues, big figure there, standing in the port, looking very menacing. He's an absolutely lovely man. And he said, you know, I kind of had to sort of really, you know, Lee kind of egged me on to sort of be this character.
He's a real sweetheart, but, you know,
absolutely,
at the front and look hard.
Yeah, which is exactly what he did extremely effectively. And I think it was, I mean, obviously Wilco's still got a bit of flair action going on, but the trousers are getting slimmer.
Can I quote the thing that Cosmo Vinyl said? You can have a band that looks good and plays bad, but you can't have a band that plays good and looks bad.
Absolutely.
That's an amazing... I thought it was really, really interesting.
Yeah, it's really perceptive.
There's some truth in it, too.
Absolutely.
It really is.
Yes.
You can, as long as you look fantastic, you can be awful.
Because the thing that was really different about Dr. Feelgood, in my memory at the time, was ties. It was collars and ties.
Yeah, yeah.
Because bands hadn't worn collars and ties. No. For quite a few years, apart from Bebop Deluxe, who used to wear great, huge, kind
great
of
knotted
Noel Edmonds
Kippers.
Type, you know,
yeah.
Peter Wingard, huge knots. Whereas this was very different. You know, they were the start of that whole business of groups dressing up to play, which still goes on to this day.
Yeah, and I think that's another part of the kind, you know, it was all part of taking the show seriously and putting on a show. But I think also, you know, Lee Brillo used to get very upset by kipper ties and he used to sort of, you know, he was known to sort of actually go up to people in pubs, you know, just see, if he saw a man in a kipper tie at a bar, he'd sort of, you know, take him to task and say, you know, say, look, your tie should not be any wider than your finger and that's a bleeding bedspread. And I think he actually pulled a man's tie off in a sort of drunken rage, at tie rage.
He
took it very seriously, yeah. Yes, absolutely. And I kind of like the idea that they're sort of, you know, as you say, the look's kind of revolutionary in a way. But it's almost like, you know, he's a kind of, you know, what is he? He's a kind of off-duty DI, you know, sort of corrupt.
Yeah, it's the Sweeney, isn't it?
Like, yeah, it is.
You know, it's a bit Dennis Waterman, isn't it?
Yes, he's got the dirty collar and he's just like, he's been up all night on a case sort of popping pills and he's a bit corrupt. You know,
it's
all that.
He's got
kind
a
of thing.
Bottle of whiskey in the filing cabinet.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a real TV cliche, that is, isn't it?
Yeah. No, I love it. It's fantastic. And it's and I know it inspired a lot of people to cut their hair and stop wearing flares and just look a bit sharper, I guess.
This is a picture from the Wembley Rock and Roll Festival that took place in 1972, which I think was a very significant event. This is the first time I think Wembley, open air, had been used for a kind of music thing. And these Teds came out of absolutely everywhere. See Chuck Berry, Jerry Lee Lewis, Little Richard. And I think Malcolm McLaren and Vivian Westwood were
and sold,
selling
drape jackets,
reconditioned Ted gear. But Dr. Feelgood played here.
They did.
Played to 150 people before, and they were playing. Was it really 80,000? I think it was.
Something ridiculous like that. And it looked like the night before they'd played the Railway in Pitsy, you know, to 20 people who couldn't really be bothered. But it was a sort of funny point in their trajectory because they just got a gig playing with Heinz. Who was living in Southend.
This is not the soup.
Former Tornadoes. Joe Meek, protégé.
Right.
And
love
Heinz,
interest of Joe Meek.
Allegedly so. And he was living in Southend.
Safely dead.
Indeed.
Let's say so.
He was busy selling advertising space for the Southend Echo at the time.
Was he?
Yes, he was.
Heinz was selling ads on the Southend Echo.
Yes, sad times. But he was...
Picture amongst the classifieds.
Yeah.
To advertise here, call Heinz.
That's right.
Yeah. Picture of him. Just imagine that.
He'd sort of got cottoned on to the fact there was a bit of a kind of rock and roll revival going on. So he thought, well, maybe I better sort of get a band together. And word got round the sort of local South End scene. And I think someone said to them, well, you know, this band, Dr. Feelgood, they're really good. You know, they don't look like Teds, but they're playing all these rock and roll covers. And so they went round to audition in Heinz's shed, and he wasn't too keen on them, but he said, yeah, okay, that you'll do. But they were only ever allowed in the back way. He never wanted them to be seen. I think they all looked a bit grubby and scruffy and a bit mean, and he didn't like the look of them. But
so
they
you'll
played
do,
great.
You'll do meet me at Wembley Stadium tomorrow. Bring your equipment.
They did a few
You could
gigs
say the roots
Heinz.
Of punk rock to some extent, couldn't you?
I think
Vivian
in lots of ways.
And McLaren was selling old drape jackets.
Yes.
Think when was doing 1970.
And I think actually a member of the New York Dolls was here as well.
Yeah.
And then which is another connection there. But anyway, so move forward to Dr. Feelgood. They get a recording contract with United Artists, Andrew Lauder and so forth. This is the first album. What year are we talking here?
This is 75.
75. And this was famously issued in mono, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah.
But they didn't intend
by mistake.
No, yeah.
Somebody pressed the wrong button. Isn't that right?
I think they just sort of... It wasn't like a kind of deliberate... They always wanted to make a point saying this is not a deliberate attempt to be sort of retro and, OK, we're sort of playing 60s R&B and we've got short hair and suits on, but we're not trying to be kind of retro. But obviously that was picked up on. But they just thought it sounded better in the end, you know, when they mixed it. Because they didn't like that there was a kind of craze for everything was in stereo, but if you were listening to something in a pub, you'd had sort of one sound coming
you'd
out here.
And
it wasn't,
bit, yes.
Yeah, they didn't like right. that. So yeah, that was yeah, the only yeah, reason. Yeah, it wasn't yeah. a kind of a pose or anything. But they, you know, Wilco said if you put mono on the front, everyone will just go on about that. And lo and behold, we're talking about it now.
Yes,
he was
it
right.
Worked. It was quite a big hit, wasn't it? I mean, they made a splash nationally. Pretty
yes.
much from the beginning, didn't they?
Yeah, and it also sort of made its way over to New York, and people, you know, like sort of significant New York luminaries were sort of playing it at their loft parties, and, you know, it was it sort of definitely talked about as a very influential record.
Why did they take against the Ramones? It's very interesting the bit where the Ramones support them, I think. Yes. They said something like that they thought the Ramones were just four intellectuals pretending to be little punks.
Yes.
Which I thought was quite an interesting thing to say, really.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you could say there were at least two intellectuals in this band, but they seemed to be completely authentic and, you know, it worked and
I
nobody minded.
I don't know why... Yeah, I remember... Yes, I remember that quote, and it's Lee's quote. I don't know, he didn't. Yeah, didn't seem very impressed... By
no,
them, I think, yeah, but I think they were very
kindred spirits, really.
Well, yeah, exactly. I think they were obviously quite in awe of them as well,
yeah.
And were probably rather nervous around them, and maybe that affected their manner towards them. And he just thought, well, you know,
you can't imagine them sharing Dr. Feelgood's all-consuming interest in drinking.
We're going to get on to that. The
which
drinking is heroic.
Which
will, it's just
we'll come
phenomenal.
On to.
Oh, the white
so
suit. This is
the you know the. Everybody in Dr. Feelgood had a character, but the key characters were at the front of the stage, which
yes.
were Lee Brillo and Wilco. Mm. You know, which was an extraordinary act, wasn't it? You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, how did they develop that?
Well, I think it's, you know, I suppose, as you say, going back to the look, that was a big part of kind of, you know, reinforcing these characters. You've got almost like they're kind of chess pieces. You've got the Black King and the White King. Or, you know, and I suppose part of what was so electric was that you had these two incredibly strong characters. And I suppose that was quite rare. Normally you'd have, you know, a very strong front man and, you know, the rest of the band. So you've got these almost like two planets colliding. But
with a lot of rivalry eventually, wasn't
yeah,
it? Because I
yeah.
think, which one was the more popular? Was it Wilco?
Wilco,
because,
yeah.
Because afterwards, be a huge queue of people to meet Wilco and get his autograph, and not very many for Lee, which
yes.
he found heartbreaking. You know?
Absolutely. I mean, I suppose I can't imagine Lee caring too much about that, but I suppose in a way, I suppose it's just a sort of male kind of pride thing. He would
not outwardly,
it would have a little, yeah. it would chip away at you a bit. And I suppose, you know, they you know, there were problems, and they Lee drank a lot. At the time, Wilco was teetotal, but he was on speed all the time. So those sorts of things
do create... You can imagine
create...
that's a perfect marriage.
Okay, a bit
one's
of a separation
kind of gnashing
there.
Furiously in his hotel room.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. But, you know, when on stage, it really looked fantastic. And, you know, so you had sort of Wilco just zooming around the
he
stage.
Did. I mean,
he was like on rails. Guitar. Yeah. And while he was doing that, Lee would be completely ignoring him or having a drink or just sort of staring at someone. But, you know, one of the things that Wilco always said was that, for him, no matter what anyone else said, Lee was the star. Lee was the kind of commander of this army. And Wilco, he said, if you look at footage of us, I'm looking to him. And it's almost like he's giving me my directions. And, you know, I'll go off and do a solo. And he's, you know, so, and you can see that. He is sort of always looking to Lee for his sort of, you know, directive in a way. And, right. and that's all part of the kind of show, I suppose.
The famous white suits that he adopts, which is obviously the least practical piece of kit.
Yeah.
For somebody planning to do a club tour. Tell us, how did that... Did
that
it get launched?
That was deliberate, wasn't it? It was there to show the grime.
Never knowingly bothering a dry cleaner.
I remember seeing him, he rolled on the floor and spilt beer and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it's because it's quite a physical show, as you say. You know, doing press-ups and kind of like rolling around on the floor. And you know, yeah, it was kind of like a defiance about wearing white and then doing all that and never cleaning it. And, you know, the clothes would literally
never
just
cleaned
be...
Never cleaned it.
Well, apparently not. Of course, I spoke to one of the roadies and he said, you know, it's all true.
It had its own flight case. Yeah.
It'll just be taken off and thrown into a flight case. Take it out the next night and put it on again.
Right.
And apparently it really was quite foul for everybody to sort of... nobody wanted to be near it at all. But yeah, legendary, sort of, you know, battle-worn, blackened white jacket that was just sort of became so legendary that the enemy only needed to put that up and everybody knew whose jacket it was.
Right, right. So they put out two albums and then they put out the live album, didn't they? Which was, that was the big breakthrough, wasn't it?
Yes.
Went straight to number one.
Yes, Stupidity, the live album, went to number one. And I think that was really significant for lots of reasons, of course. But I think for... you know, Lee and Wilco and, you know, the whole band, they really felt that, you know, it's all very well putting out these studio albums, but the people who come to see us and love us because of the live show, and it's very hard to convey that in a studio. And they came pretty close, you know. It's hard to record, you know, have a live album. You don't really get the full sense of it, obviously, but they came pretty close and it just, yeah, rocked.
Describe what went wrong here, because, it's, you know, Wilco then, right at their very peak, it appeared, just left the band or was sort of pushed out. You couldn't tell if he was pushed out or he jumped.
But, well, I mean, I would say, I mean, I hope not upsetting anyone here, but I would say he was pushed out. He says he was pushed out, but, I mean, it certainly sounds like, you know, from talking to everybody who was there, you know, it was if it wasn't that, it would have been something else. They sort of almost found a reason because it just got so bad. It certainly didn't come from nowhere, that sort of final row. It had just sort of been building
America,
up.
He hated America, didn't he?
He hated America.
He couldn't have any success in America because he loathed the place. And was
yeah, that was a big problem.
A problem just
it?
Sulked.
Yeah, that was a big problem because they were, you know, everything was primed for them to really kind of crack America and it just, you know, unfortunately just went horribly wrong. They were given a tour with supporting Kiss, of all people, which you can't really imagine that working, but... And the first date, they were like, right, you know, this is a big opportunity. We'll be playing stadiums. Fantastic. Let's do it. And they turn up for the first date in Alabama. And they're blocked by Kiss's road crew who say, you can't come backstage. Kiss can't be seen without their makeup. And so they were stopped, and they said, well, you're going to have to change in the bog's front of house. And they just said...
They just said, we're not doing it.
Wilco had it through a wobbler, and they were chucked.
That doesn't play well in Canvey Island.
Well, you know, he probably could have got away with that maybe here, but, you know, nobody really knew who they were at that stage in America. He just didn't care. It was like, well, you know, just get rid of them, and so they were sent
home. So they also toured with Gentle Giant, didn't they?
Yes.
Which is even more unlikely than Kiss, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. They got on really well with Gentle Giant because when they came over for one of these...
sweet guys.
these CBS conventions, they kind of hung out with them, and I think maybe that was where the connection was. Yeah, lovely guys, but it didn't go well because obviously Gentle Giant's fans hated Dr. Feelgood. They couldn't stand them, and they just sort of heckled and abused them every single night, and they were Lee Brillo doggedly trying to take the Feelgoods through this set every night, and it got to the stage where even Gentle Giant sort of sat them down and said, why are you doing this? Why are you putting yourselves through this? This is awful, even to witness. But it was just, you know, determined, this is what we're here to do, but it just didn't work for them.
So Wilco leaves, John Jippy Mayo... joins.
Yes.
And he's a very good guitar player.
He's fantastic,
but
yeah.
The charisma is gone, hasn't it? I mean, do you think that's fair to say?
Well, I think it's really hard to follow someone like Wilco Johnson. I think, you know, Jippy Mayo was like a kind of a rock star in his own right. And he had so much going for him, but I think following Wilco must have been incredibly hard. And Lee always said to him, you know, don't try and do a Wilco, you know, just be yourself and just do your thing. And he played in a very different way. He was an amazing musician and could pretty much pick up any musical instrument at all and play it with great proficiency. So he was a star in his own right. But obviously, it would never be quite the same as the sort of definitive lineup.
You don't have that danger. That's the thing about Wilco. You thought, what's he going to do now?
Uncontrollable.
It really did
look
absolutely uncontrollable. Now, this picture also just sees them pursuing their key hobby.
Yeah, this is their natural habitat, isn't it? In fact, was it the Admiral Jellicoe?
Admiral Jellicoe pub on Canvey Island.
But
yes, essential research going on here.
Drinking's what they did, isn't it?
Absolutely right, yeah. I mean, it was if they were on tour as well, I'd be drinking all the time. But, you know, the routine when they were back home on Canvey was sort of get up, have a cup of tea, you know, have some breakfast, go down the jelly, start shooting some pool, just start drinking, and just sort of, you know, any of the characters who'd come in, just sort of hang out with them for the day. And people would come from all over the world to, you know, once they cottoned on to the fact that this was the Feelgoods local, and come and visit the Admiral Jellicoe on Canvey Island.
But it's also a kind of music that can benefit from the people performing it being pissed. You know, it's quite interesting. Because they used to get really drunk before they went on, didn't they?
Yeah, that's
right. And felt it made it better.
You know,
I mean, you know, if you were a member of Steely Dan, you wouldn't get blind drunk because you've got to play something in 13, 12 time signature, you know. But in a way, that might have been partly their undoing, that they were in a world where, you know, they were expected to be drunk, and they were drunk.
It was being stoked and facilitated from all directions. I think it was one of the things that irritated Wilco was, you know, he'd be writing, other than the covers, obviously, you know, that he was the main songwriter, and he'd say, and Lee would go on and sing the same verse three times because he was out of his head.
Right.
And he'd just be like, well, I bleeding wrote that, you know. So whereas when Jippy came along, he was absolutely up for the party and up for the drinking, and it all fitted very nicely.
So this continued right through the rest of their working life, didn't it?
Yes.
The kind of drinking came first, didn't it?
Yes.
Before the gigs, they were.
Yeah, the priorities.
They were going, they'd have three bottles of wine at lunch.
Yeah, and a nice lunch as well was very important as well. They would route tours around where the sort of the best
roast dinner
restaurants were. You know, that was very much a Lee Brillo thing. You know, it had to be, you know, his little sort of Michelin sort of guide by his side. And, you know, we're going to go to this place now. And that was absolutely a huge part of touring, certainly, you know, from the 80s, you know, because touring is very hard to eat well, isn't it? So he took that very seriously, and
right.
It almost got to the stage where lunch was actually more important than the gig. The weird thing was he liked to go to nice establishments.
Right.
But nice establishments didn't always want the feel-goods
in
them.
Right, no.
That's part of your gentleman concept, probably.
Yes, exactly.
So did he get turned away from dining rooms?
I think people attempted to turn him away, but I think he's quite a hard man to turn away. But, I mean, there was one story where they booked, he'd rung an advance and he'd booked a table at this nice place on the way to the gig, and they all turned up looking quite scruffy, and there was a bar and they bought themselves a drink and they were just waiting, for lunchtime. And then they were about to head through to the restaurant and the proprietor said, I'm sorry, you can't come in. We're fully booked. And he said, well, I booked a table. You know, one of those tables is right. No, no. It was quite clear that she just didn't want them there. And he had his drink in his hand. He said, well, if you want us to behave like animals, we'll behave like animals. And he just tipped his pint onto the floor in front of her.
So he said, all right, you can have a table then. Yeah. That works.
Do come in. Yes, yeah. So, you know, he would take offence at things like that. You know, sort of little petty injustices really pissed him off.
Did he have any remorse about his drinking?
It certainly didn't look that way. I think he enjoyed it. It was a part of his, you know, a lot of people would say I never really saw him kind of absolutely, you know, blind drunk kind of. He was seemed to be pretty much in control of it, apparently. And it was just something that he enjoyed. He liked drinking. He liked eating. He liked kind of living in quite a sort of full,
right,
Indulgent way, I suppose. Yeah. But he worked really hard, and I suppose he sort of thought that was all kind of part of the thing. But this is Shirley. This is
these high quality snaps. I'm sorry, that scanned out of your book.
You do feel so sorry for the rock and roll wives, though, because you know it's such an abnormal situation that the husbands are either never there because they're on tour in Europe, or they're there all the time.
Yes,
you know, and neither of those things are particularly fantastic. Really.
Well, Shirley was quite rock and roll. Shirley was quite rock and roll as well, and I think they, you know, he definitely met his match in Shirley, and you know she would say, you know, if he, it's probably just as well he wasn't there all the time, because that, you know, she was keeping up with the drinking, and you know she was from Louisiana, so she was kind of part of a kind of drinking culture as well, you know. She was
so he met her on tour in Louisiana.
Well, actually she was living in San Francisco at the time, and they met at a party there, and actually San Francisco was one of the, you know, they actually did really well there, and in New York and LA and sort of those sorts of places they actually went down really well. Basically, it was at a party where a band called Clover were playing.
Oh, we know them well.
I'm sure you'd... Yeah, Huey Lewis's band, Clover.
First Elvis Costello album, weren't they?
Yeah.
And Nick Lowe was a massive fan, Lowe was with them at the Feel Goods in America at the time. So we've got to go and see Clover. They're fantastic. They're as good as the band, you know. And they sort of tracked them down. They were playing at a party and sort of hung out a bit. And Clover invited Lee up on stage to sing with them. And they hadn't heard Lee and they hadn't seen Dr. Field, but they just thought they were kind of being nice and he's a singer. But they thought, well, he's quite conservative and mild-mannered. I don't think this is really going to... You know, they didn't really know what to expect. And so he sort of, you know, ambled up to the stage, not really wanting to do it, but, you know, and got up there and just blew their heads off. And I think they did a version of Checking Up on My Baby or something, and it was just so incendiary. People were just sort of gaping open mouth, just looking at this madman on the stage who just 5 minutes ago was sort of quietly sipping a gin and tonic at the bar. So it was all part of this kind of rock and roll Jekyll and Hyde character. But that was when Shirley first encountered Lee, and
she came back to Canvey Island.
She did, yes.
From Louisiana.
Yes, yeah.
It has quite a lot in common, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. She said, you know, certainly the kind of the oil refineries and the kind of swampy marshes and the shacks and, you know, definitely parallels.
But it was a kind of on-off relationship, is that fair to say? Or?
Well, it was a fiery relationship, I suppose. I think they both kind of absolutely bonded, you know, straight away and were crazy about each other, but, you know, both quite sort of strong characters, to say the least. And I think, you know, she actually said it herself, you know, if he wasn't away a lot of the time, their marriage might not have continued, because they did have a couple of breaks and all the rest of it, but, you know, obviously a massive amount of love there.
That's brilliant. So it was him being away that made the relationship work then. Yeah, that's good. That's
quite an intense sort of character, I suppose,
But eventually got married.
Yes,
right,
they did.
Right.
And 2 days after, he was off on tour again, which didn't go down very well.
No
honeymoon.
Right.
So, straight
and had children.
Yes, they did, two kids. Kelly and Nicholas, and the funny thing is that Kelly is actually a lawyer now, so she's sort of there must be some kind of solicitor legal DNA that she's kind of working through, because, you know, obviously that was
got a rock star's kid who's got a proper job. That's
that's rebellion.
That's
not
that's the ultimate
wreck.
Rebellion.
Yeah. That's the ultimate rebellion.
Yes.
So sorry, I just wanted
Borneo Fred Munt, isn't that?
They wanted somebody to help, you know, control their drinking, so they got a former drinking partner of the Bonzo Dog Doodah.
But also, that's part of the whole folklore, isn't it, of hanging around with people called Borneo Fred Munt?
Yes.
I mean, that's back to your gentleman thing again, isn't
Absolutely,
it?
Absolutely,
ludicrous,
yeah.
Faux aristocratic goons.
Well, they used to sort of collect characters, apparently, on the road, and they just sort of just kind of loved it, because, you know, a certain element of touring is quite boring, you know, sitting around in vans and all that, so they kind of collect strange, eccentric people and kind of take them with them. And after a while, obviously, that would sometimes start to kind of pall a bit. But, you know, it was just they you know, Fred, Borneo Fred Munt was entertaining. You know, he'd come, he'd just sort of do really mad things or kind of like take them to kind of, he was quite a bad influence on them, I think, you know, if that was even possible. But
so was Lee just in love with the life in the end? You know, because Dr. Feelgood, they reached a certain point and then they never got beyond it in terms of commercial appeal.
Yeah, I think.
But they kept on, you know, there was always a Dr. Feelgood, wasn't there?
Absolutely. I think it was almost, I hope I'm not being unfair in saying it seemed like a bit of an obsession from Lee's point of view to sort of keep on playing. It was almost like the way he would talk about Dr. Feelgood was almost like he was talking about a public service. You know, we've got to keep gigging, you know, cheering people up and sort of giving people a sort of an hour of escapism. And, you know, he very much saw it in those terms. And it didn't matter if there was only one person in the audience, the promoter hadn't done their job, they were doing that show and they were doing it as well as possible. And he sort of very much had that kind of old showman kind of ethos. And I think certainly, but yeah, I mean, the drinking was a massive part of it, and certainly to, you know, in the early 80s, Figure and Sparko, the drummer and the bass player of the sort of definitive lineup, just were exhausted and they just can't take it anymore. And it's just such a shame because they just needed a bit of time off and it just wasn't going
to
happen.
They wanted to go home and go to bed.
Just have a bit of a sleep. Yeah, see their family for the first time in a couple of years.
No, I can entirely see that.
But he was sort of dogged in his sort of determination to just keep touring, keep working. Quite obsessive.
I threw this in because this was...
I'd look this up today because I'd...
This was his favourite book, wasn't it?
And this
it?
Is a book, it's a pastiche of an 18th century gentleman's diary, and it describes the lead character as someone who fires his pistol at dissenters, poachers and foreigners. It's brilliant. And it's all full of kind of, rambunctious drinking types and prostitutes. It's just a hilarious spoof, isn't it?
So that was that, but that was that part of him.
Yeah,
it was a very
yeah.
important side of him.
Yeah.
So did he make any money?
I think he did. I mean, he called his house, he famously called his house the Proceeds. There's a ceramic
flat.
They didn't
say that outside.
The
outside.
Proceeds, yes.
That's a good one.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. And weirdly enough, I actually, when my husband and I moved... to Leon C, we found a flat there. We were just renting at the time, and weirdly enough, we realised that we were actually living next door to the Proceeds.
It
was a coincidence. It was very, very strange. I hadn't started working on the Lee book at that point. I was working with Wilco on his book, but it was just very odd sort of synchronicities of meant to be. But yeah, the Proceeds. Yeah, he did. He was. I think he was quite canny.
Didn't they dress up in tweeds? You know.
Oh yes, he had a monocle and a fez.
Monocle and go into with a fez.
Yes,
like deerstalker.
Yes,
go into Soho and hang around. I love
absolutely,
it.
Absolutely,
I love that dedication to being completely bonkers.
It's all sort of like assuming characters,
yeah.
You know, he read lots of, you know. As you say, yeah, books like that, and he loved kind of film, and it was almost like he kind of absorbed characters into himself, and it was almost just sort of fun, I suppose. But he also liked kind of messing with people a little bit, so he'd kind of wear a very sort of tweedy suit and maybe a deerstalker, but carry a Millwall bag, just because he knew that it would confuse people on the train. And it was just, yeah, he was just sort of like constantly taking the piss, basically.
So what happened? He got ill?
He did, yes. He was very young. He passed away. Last week was the 22-year anniversary
God,
of his passing. Yeah, so he was 41 when he died. I was just a month away from his 42nd birthday. And the weird thing is that it's hard to believe he was that young for lots of reasons, but it was almost like he lived his life in fast forward. It was almost, even from being a kid, he was so ahead of his time. Everyone thought he was at least five years older. And certainly when he was my age, you know, sort of late 30s, he was almost behaving a bit like a sort of an elderly country gent. You know, so it was quite a strange, you know, he was very much doing his own thing and doing what he wanted. But it was almost like, I don't know if I'm sort of being, I don't know, but it was almost like maybe subliminally he felt like maybe he didn't have that much time. And so he
had such an upbeat, you know, attitude towards being ill, wasn't he? He was so kind of, you know, enthusiastic and
yeah,
pushing ahead.
Absolutely. And he continued as long as he could. And, you know, I think it was massively, incredibly harrowing for everybody around him. But he seemed very philosophical. And obviously, you know, the love of food didn't wane, and people would sort of sneak curries into hospital, you know, and sort of like they'd draw the curtains around him and sort of set it up with napkins and do it all very nicely. He loved a curry. And, you know, even towards the end, he was sort of very morphined up and, you know, sort of rambling away. One of the things he said was...
That's a brilliant idea.
He said, what's for dinner? I haven't seen the menu yet. That was one of the last things that he said to one of his friends who came to visit. I mean, he was even there, you know, it was all about kind of the things he loved to do. But he was determined to do two shows when it really didn't look very good. And it was Christmas time, I think the Christmas before he went. And he said to Chris Fenwick, I want to do two shows. And Chris said, are you sure that's a good idea? You're not sort of very strong. He said, well, I might be even less strong, you know, after that. So let's not wait. Let's just do it. Please organise it for me. And so it was organised. Two dates on Canvey Island at the Dr. Feelgood Bar. And they recorded one of the nights, sort of made a live album out of it called Down at the Doctor's, which I'm sure many of you know. And it is an absolutely fantastic album. And his voice sounds amazing. And you can't believe that someone so frail could just... It was almost like, I don't know, he was channeling. I don't know. There was just something amazing about how he sounded that night. But, you know, pictures of him are very distressing. He just doesn't look like him at all. He's like a little old man, very, very frail. But this voice just transcended his illness. And I think after that it was very kind of psychologically quite difficult for him, because then he realised that probably really is it. You know, I probably am not going to do this again.
Can you think of any bands where you could feel, subsequently, where you could feel the repercussions of the Feelgoods you felt that were really influenced by them?
Oh, definitely, yeah. I mean, especially now, actually. Yeah. It sort of feels like there's a real renaissance to that style. You know, bands like the Stripes, they're the first people who come to mind, or with the 45s. Very young, you know, kids, but absolutely in love with that... you know, that whole shtick and the energy and the attitude, and also the kind of the R&B music. Because, of course, punk was massively inspired by the Feelgoods, but they weren't, you know, playing the same music. But it was more about the attitude and the style, I suppose. Yeah. But, the people like the Stripes. I think people are in... I think it's a lot is thanks to Oil City Confidential waking people up to the sound of the Feelgoods again. People are rediscovering those records, and they're just so great. You know, they're just so good.
It's also the look and the attitude, isn't it? And it's a great English figure, and a worthy memoir. That's Lee Brillo, Rock and Roll Gentleman, by Zoe Howe. Will you say thank you to Zoe Howe?
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And Zoe, I'm sure, will be happy to sign a copy of the book, which I think they've got them out there at the...
This podcast was brought to you by The Word,